The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
LinkedIn presents.
Normally, birds of a feather flock together. Republicans tend to marry Republicans, and Democrats tend to marry Democrats. However, if there's something we don't like about ourselves, we tend to be turned off when we see someone else displaying that same disliked attribute. Tightwads and spendthrifts don't like being tightwads and spendthrifts. And in large surveys of married couples, we find that tightwads and spendthrifts are more likely to marry each other than they are to marry someone like themselves.
Hi, this is the Next Big Idea Daily. I'm your host, Michael Kovnat. Are you a tightwad? It's okay, you can admit it. I kind of am one too. Or are you a spendthrift? You know, money's not real. I deserve to buy this. It's okay, some of my best friends are spendthrifts. But whatever your relationship with money is, you may have noticed it can be a really dangerous topic in relationships. Financial conversations are tough for most couples, but navigating economic hurdles, along with romantic ones, can be done with extremely positive results, according to Scott Rick, author of the new book, Tightwads and Spendthrifts, Navigating the Money Minefield in Real Relationships. Scott is an author and a marketing professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. He's got a PhD in behavioral decision research from Carnegie Mellon, where he was a National Science Foundation graduate research fellow. Here he is to help with the money problems in your relationship.
On paper, tightwads and spendthrifts look very different. Tightwads are people who experience a lot of psychological distress when considering optional purchases. And spendthrifts are people who don't experience enough distress when considering those kinds of purchases. As you might imagine, tightwads are generally in a lot better shape financially than spendthrifts, based on just about any metric you can think of. But tightwads and spendthrifts are more similar than they appear at first glance. They both experience a lot of conflict and regret. Tightwads consistently tell stories about purchases they wish they made. For instance, in my research, I talked with a tightwad who worked a very high-paying job. His wife loved going to fancy restaurants, but he couldn't psychologically cope with the prices at those kinds of restaurants. So, on a special occasion, he took his wife to Ruby Tuesday. She was so disappointed, and he regretted the decision for a long time. We see comparable stories of regret from spendthrifts. Now, personally, I'm a Mount Rushmore-level spendthrift, so I can just share one of my own stories. I was in Chicago for a few days on a work trip, and I made my way to Saks Fifth Avenue, which we don't have where I live in Ann Arbor, Michigan. While there, I came across a beautiful pair of blue suede shoes. I thought they might be a pretty snazzy addition to my teaching wardrobe, but the salesperson politely informed me that they were driving loafers and weren't really meant for any kind of formal event. Well, I slept on the purchase for a few days, and in that time, I managed to conjure up just enough potential usage occasions to justify the purchase. Now, like I said, I live in Michigan, where the weather is not always friendly to suede shoes, and I don't really like going to the beach, so I wouldn't exactly say I've gotten my money's worth from these shoes. But they are nice to look at in the closet. Financial opposites attract. Normally, birds of a feather flock together. Republicans tend to marry Republicans, and Democrats tend to marry Democrats. However, if there's something we don't like about ourselves, we tend to be turned off when we see someone else displaying that same disliked attribute. It can shine a really uncomfortable spotlight on our own problem. This is relevant to our story because tightwads and spendthrifts don't like being tightwads and spendthrifts. And in large surveys of married couples, we find that tightwads and spendthrifts are more likely to marry each other than they are to marry someone like themselves. These differences are probably fun and interesting at first. The tightwad might initially be amused and fascinated by how their spendthrift partner handles money, and vice versa. But as the relationship continues, and the financial decisions that partners confront start getting more and more serious, those differences can become irritating. Indeed, we find that the more that spouses differ on the tightwad spendthrift dimension, the more they argue over money, and the less satisfied they are with the marriage. Sociologists also see this in their research on so-called fatal attraction. Sometimes, the very quality that initially attracts us to someone is the same quality that repels us later. Now, I should note that tightwad spendthrift marriages are not doomed. I say this with some confidence, as a spendthrift happily married to a tightwad, like a real tightwad. But, of course, these differences must be navigated carefully. Complete financial transparency within relationships is overrated. There's a lot of concern in the personal finance world about financial infidelity within relationships. It sounds pretty bad, right? Infidelity. But when I see how people define financial infidelity, I don't feel so worried about it. For many financial experts, any behavior that falls short of complete, proactive transparency about how you've used money is considered financial infidelity. I'll share one example from a popular financial advice website. Imagine you go to the grocery store and buy $100 worth of groceries. You pay with a debit card and withdraw $20 in cash with your purchase. But you don't report the cash withdrawal to your spouse. If your spouse sees the account activity, they'll just think you spent $120 on groceries. They won't know that you had a secret $20 in cash to spend elsewhere. And now you have officially committed an act of financial infidelity. Now, I don't think this kind of rigid perspective is that useful. For most couples, learning exactly how your spouse spends money is likely to lead to more harm than good. One problem is that many people have become convinced that small purchases are all that stand between them and becoming rich. This idea is commonly referred to as the latte factor. Simply put, if you could refrain from purchasing small indulgences like the occasional latte, you could instead invest that money and become rich. Now, the math doesn't really support this idea, but many people have come to believe it. Complete transparency can shine an unnecessary spotlight on small purchases that seem more important than they actually are. Instead of financial transparency, I recommend financial translucency. Partners should have a general sense of how much money the other partner is spending per week or per month. But the precise details of how that money is spent do not need to be proactively shared. A little bit of privacy is essential for maintaining a sense of individuality. Don't ask your spouse what kind of gift they want. Who among us has not turned to the internet every once in a while for some gift-giving advice? If you're part of this group, you have no doubt encountered articles suggesting that we just ask the people in our life what kind of gift they would like, and then give them the requested gift. This is well-meaning advice, meant to avoid gifts that are so bad that they shake the very foundation of the relationship. But there are real problems with this just ask advice. First of all, it's really easy to get the timing and phrasing of that question all wrong. You can imagine someone saying to their partner, "All right, well, I guess your birthday's coming up. You didn't really like what I got you last year, so could you just tell me what to buy you this year?" Oh, how romantic. Second, a good gift requires some degree of surprise. Why else would we be using all this wrapping paper? So, what's a better approach to gift giving? Within intimate relationships, gift-giving occasions are important opportunities to communicate how well we understand our partner. We all want to feel seen and understood. If you want to give gifts that strengthen your relationship, you need to understand your partner's inner psychological world. What's making them happy nowadays? What they're looking forward to? What's stressing them out? It's a kind of understanding that partners can only achieve when they are curious about each other and periodically set aside some time to explore each other's psychological worlds. These are not conversations about who's taking the kids to soccer or who's going to call the plumber tomorrow. Those conversations are necessary in a functional household, but they're not going to help you learn much about your partner. You also need to have conversations that aren't about practical household matters. Don't just marry for love or money. Marry for well-being. The great Gatsby author F. Scott Fitzgerald once offered a famous piece of dating advice. Don't marry for money. Go where the money is, then marry for love. It's not the worst advice I've heard. It correctly highlights that both love and money are essential. But let's think carefully about the suggestion to, quote, go where the money is. That's easier said than done, isn't it? We spend most of our time around people with similar socioeconomic characteristics. And the upper echelons of society are not exactly throwing open their doors to welcome everyone in. And let's say you do find a partner with loads of money. Great. But are you sure they're eager to share those resources with you? Plenty of people live in apparent luxury, but feel cash-strapped because their partner believes in strict boundaries between their money and your money. Now, money cannot be ignored, of course. The couple needs a certain amount to survive. And love is also essential. You absolutely need both. But love and money are not enough. You also need similar interests, values, plans, and dreams. Not identical, but similar enough. You can have all the love and money in the world, but if one partner wants to live on a farm and raise lots of children, and the other partner wants to live in the city and have no children, that's a huge cause for concern. So I suggest that you marry for well-being. Now, certainly, well-being requires enough love and enough money within the relationship, but it also requires having enough psychological similarity.
Here's a tip that won't cost you a dime. Sign up for my free newsletter. I'll send you a weekly roundup of the best new ideas in nonfiction. You can sign up using the link in the episode notes or by searching for The Next Big Idea on LinkedIn. Okay, that's it for the week. These episodes were written by me, Michael Kovnat, and edited by Caleb Bissinger. The Next Big Idea Daily is part of the LinkedIn Podcast Network. We'll see you Monday.